Welcome to the Nutrition Science Podcast, where we help you cut through the noise and make informed, science-based decisions about nutrition and your health. All right, welcome back to the Nutrition Science Podcast. I am looking forward to this episode today. Today, we're going to talk about plant-based nutrition, how to get started with a plant-based diet. I have a guest that's going to be talking about this topic who's really educated on the topic, Dr. Matthew Nagra. Welcome, Dr. Nagra.
Thanks for having me. And yeah, we've chatted for, I feel like, almost years at this point and never actually really spoken face-to-face, so it's kind of nice.
Yeah, definitely. It's always good to connect with people that I've been connected with online. And Dr. Nagra is a naturopathic doctor out of Vancouver, also what I would consider a plant-based diet advocate, someone who is himself a vegan and is a proponent of this dietary pattern for a lot of people. And a lot of people, those of you who are listening to the podcast, might think, okay, you're having a naturopathic vegan on. What's going on? You'll hear throughout this episode, and something, you know, Dr. Nagra and I have been connected for a long time, and he is just, he knows the science. He really presents it well. He has read the research. I'm someone who has myself read the research, and I know a lot of these studies that he's talking about when he presents them on Instagram, and he presents them in a very unbiased way. And I really like the way that he presents the data and really, you know, gives an unbiased side of why following a plant-based diet might be a good thing to do. So I'm happy to have him today so that we can discuss that. And I know that there's a lot of people who are, you know, you're considering going on a plant-based diet for a variety of reasons. And sometimes there's a lot of things that you just need to consider going into it, some things that you need to be paying attention to make sure that you're getting your nutritional needs met. And that's what we're going to talk about today, is how to adopt a vegan diet, how to adopt a plant-based diet, if you want to do so, or if you just want to move more towards a plant-based diet, more, you know, a more plant-based diet than what you're doing before. This episode is going to give you all the tips and tricks and strategies and things that you need to do to make sure that you're doing that in the healthiest way possible. So I am looking forward to the discussion. Thanks for coming on, Dr. Nagra. And I want to start with just kind of talking about your journey. What got you into nutrition, why this has become something that's really important to you, and then why you decided to start to follow a plant-based diet?
Yeah. And again, thanks for having me on. So when I was younger, I didn't really take my nutrition too seriously when I was, you know, into my early teens. But I was an athlete my whole life. I played a ton of sports, soccer and martial arts. I have a black belt in Taekwondo. I did a lot as far as activity, but I still struggled with my weight. I had asthma that was pretty significant at points. You know, my skin would break out, just those sorts of things. Nothing maybe life-threatening at the time, but things that were certainly bothersome. And it was my personal trainer, actually, when I was 15, who really promoted more of a plant-based diet. Now, I didn't take him seriously for quite a while because, again, I was a 15-year-old, didn't really care. But he wanted me to record everything that I ate for a couple of weeks, a food diary, which I'm sure you're familiar with. I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with. And I was thinking, oh man, he's gonna, you know, see my diet. It's so bad. And, you know, I've got the McDonald's, the chicken nuggets, all you know, these things in there. So I thought, you know what, I'm just gonna try to adopt some of his recommendations for these couple of weeks and just impress him. So I didn't lie on the food diary. I actually made changes. So, you know, it's a little bit better. And so I actually, at the time, and I think we'll get into maybe dairy and that. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, but dairy was one of the first things that I got rid of. So I got rid of that. I got rid of sort of your classic ultra-processed foods, you know, potato chips, sodas, those types of things. Reduced my meat intake, was having a lot more fruits and veggies, having smoothies every day for, you know, breakfast or as a snack, that sort of thing. And I started losing weight. My skin was clearing up. I felt like I was breathing easier, probably due to some of that weight loss. And I just thought, you know, that this is, maybe there's something to this. Maybe there is something to what we eat. And from there, I just spent the next few years learning more and more. I didn't always go to the most evidence-based places. Like, if I knew what I know now, I probably would have gone a different route and found my way to where I am in a different way. But hey, it got me here eventually. So I'm happy about that. But over the next few years, I just kept making, you know, subtle changes until eventually I went to university and started sliding the other way. I was drinking on weekends, I was eating cafeteria food, and I just came to a point where I was like, you know what, I'm not feeling as good as I was like 6 months ago. So I decided on the spot that I was going to go 100% all in plant-based. And then the ethics and other things came into it, within that year timeframe, we'll say, just afterwards.
Cool, cool. So at what point, what took you into wanting to become a naturopathic doctor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so now another piece to this story about nutrition is my dad actually had, there has been some miscommunication or misinterpretation of what actually happened. We were told that he had a heart attack when I was actually in the hospital for a surgery on a broken fibula. And he had this issue out in the waiting room. So probably the best place for that to happen. And so for the next couple of years, he also, I mean, he was really struggling with sort of the anxiety around that, you know, situation, and you know, he'd have panic attacks, thinks it's a heart attack, and it was certainly a struggle for that period. I don't think that's something that a lot of people realize is you know how much it affects you after, even once you're through it. And he started eventually making some changes to his diet in the same sort of direction, and he saw improvements in all his biomarkers. He felt better. He finally was more confident in his health, and so between his experience and mine, I thought, you know, I want to help people with their nutritional choices, but I was also very interested in medicine. So that's something that is good to put out there, that I was always thinking of something in the medical field. And, you know, this sort of swayed me towards maybe nutrition is really important as well. And I actually had some teachers in my undergrad, one of them in particular, who actually saw a couple naturopathic doctors in Victoria, BC, where I went to school. And she suggested that I had shadowed them. And I'd known a little bit about it, but not a type. It's kind of what you read online. And I thought, okay, I'll give it a shot. And I went and shadowed. And I just thought the scope was so broad. They could prescribe medications. And I want to clarify that this is different everywhere. So yes, how I practice in BC or how we're regulated in BC is not going to be the same as every state, every province. In some places, it's not regulated at all. And anybody can call themselves a naturopath. So just understand that.
Another thing I want to point out, because yeah, I know a lot of my listeners are in the U.S., it's much more common in Canada, and it's, as you mentioned, much more regulated, but there's more naturopaths, and you're going to be more likely to get a naturopath that's going to function as like your primary care doctor, whereas like in the U.S., that's, in most places, that's non-existent. You can't really find that around here.
I see. Yeah. Because in BC here, we are considered primary care providers. Now, I usually want to work with a GP. I like my patient to have both. And so we can work together. I think that ultimately leads to the best care. But yeah, I saw that we could prescribe medications. Obviously, there's nutrition counseling. There's like some that really focus on physical therapies, kind of like a physiotherapist for injuries and that sort of thing. And these were areas I was interested in. So I thought, you know, maybe I'll look more into this. I spent a day at the school attending some classes just to feel it out. And I ultimately kind of liked it and obviously did a bit more research into it and thought that, you know, if I want to practice in a way where I can incorporate medicine, but also have a large focus on nutrition and spend like an hour with patients, at least on the first visit, this might be actually a really good route for me. And that's ultimately what led me down that road. And now I know full well that there are certain modalities within the naturopathic realm that are not at all evidence-based. Like obviously nutrition counseling can be evidence-based depending on how you practice it. Medication, obviously we know about that. There are things like physical therapies. There are certain injection therapies. We can do like corticosteroid shots for joints, for example. We can do iron infusions now, which is something I've offered for patients who aren't responsive to iron supplementation. But then there are the things like certain botanical medicines, things like homeopathy that I don't think have solid support and I just don't practice them. Like it's as simple as that. So it will depend a lot on the practitioner that you're seeing. And that is sort of where I always tell people to do what's called like a meet and greet or discovery call or something like that if they were considering seeing someone, simply because then you can feel it out, you can speak with them, ask about their approach and better understand it. But yeah, I'm certainly not unaware of concerns that are out there, and I think a lot of them are warranted.
Yeah, and I think it's actually worse in the U.S., I think is what's where sometimes a lot of the perceptions for myself and from some of the people that follow me come from is the Canada. I do think that there's a higher percentage of practitioners who are doing it in an evidence-based way. And in the U.S., I haven't really seen that as much, but maybe that's also changing. And it's funny that parts of your story that are very, very similar to mine. So
you know, I was an athlete. I had allergies and asthma and like joint pain and all this stuff. And changing my diet was like, I felt the difference. And this was in my early 20s. And that's what like just opened my eyes. I was like, I want to do this. And I was always interested in the medical field. And I didn't know what naturopathy was. And so for me, nutrition, I was like, nutrition is the most important thing. So that's why I'm going to get a PhD in nutrition. And then I learned about like naturopathy, and I almost like I was considering like switching over at the same time, but I did, you know, I'm young, 22, 23 years old, just trying to figure out. And I had never heard of these things. So I'm like looking into them and learning about them. And it's, like you said, it's very appealing. It's like, okay, you get opportunity to spend more time with your patients. You get to prescribe, you get to, cause I was in Arizona where there's that school of naturopathic medicine there. And right when I like moved there, I saw that and I was like, what is this? This is, sounds very interesting. And I looked into it and truly considered it for a period of time just because of the same reason you said. I was just always interested in healthcare. But you know, the traditional model leaves a lot on the table, in terms of, you know, really not addressing nutrition, lifestyle. And, in my opinion, nutrition is probably the most important thing, or one of the most important things in lifestyle overall. So, yeah, that's interesting. I'm glad you shared all of that. So let's get into, in terms of like plant-based diet, you said that you had adopted, you know, a plant-based diet for these reasons. And then you mentioned that, you know, now some of the ethics and things. So like, what are the main, reasons why you would recommend someone, or why like someone would consider adopting a more plant-based diet?
Yeah, I think you and I can both agree that as far as health value, a predominantly, at least, plant-based diet is generally going to be the healthiest for long-term outcomes, right? Whether that's like 80% plant-based, we'll say Mediterranean kind of style, or if you do decide to make the leap to go more 9,500%. What drives me and what I think is the strongest reason to go 100% plant-based is the ethical reason. You know, not wanting to violate the rights of the animals that we share the world with. Like, that's ultimately what it comes down to. And it's sort of an extension of rights to those animals. I think that's where there's maybe differences in the philosophy between vegans and others. Now, there's also the environmental considerations. I'm not an expert in that realm. I'm well-read enough, I would say, to understand that shifting towards plant-based agriculture is a good thing. But whether there's a marked difference between like 95%, 100%, I don't know. So I'm not going to, you know, make a strong claim about that. But I'd say the ethics are the reason to go 100%, and it can be done healthfully, and we'll talk about that. But I don't see a huge advantage, or if at all, to going 100% versus like, you know, 85, 90%, depending on what you're filling that 10, 15, 20% with.
Yeah, yeah. From a health standpoint is what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So I love this. I've never heard anyone describe it this way, and this is how I feel as well. Like, I'm kind of in that direction, like 80-ish percent plant-based. And the reason being is for the reasons that I've discussed on all of the previous podcasts. You know, the plant foods are rich in fiber, micronutrients, low in saturated fat, and, you know, all of these things lead to lower rates of the most important diseases that we're most likely to die from: cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's disease, type 2 diabetes. If we want to reduce our risk of all of those things, we should be consuming a lot of these nutrients that are going to come in higher amounts in plant foods. If you're eating a diet that is comprised of more animal foods, you're going to have higher amounts of saturated fat, lower fiber, lower amounts of all of the tens of thousands of different micronutrients that come in plant foods that are, you know, classified as phytonutrients that we talk about in other episodes that just have health benefits, especially when we consume them in, you know, adequate quantities on a regular basis as a part of our diet. So, you know, that great points there. I'm glad that you said it in that way, in terms of like, from a health standpoint, going 100%, there's probably not an additional advantage. So why would you say that though? So let's talk about that piece. Cause I think that's important, because I know some people may think, well, some people may be offended by hearing that, who are more on the plant-based, you know, nutrition side of things. So let's dig into that more. Why would you say that it's probably not, from a health standpoint, beneficial to go fully 100% plant-based?
Yeah, and I want to say this is on a population level. There might be individual differences. For example, there was a randomized controlled trial by Bernard looking at a Mediterranean diet versus a vegan diet, a low-fat vegan diet. And in that case, these participants, I believe, were classified as having overweight or obesity to start. And the low-fat vegan diet did induce more weight loss. So in that context, there may have been an advantage there just because of the lower calorie density. Mm-hmm. But on a population level, when we look at, like, let's say the Adventist Health Study 2, and you have generally a healthy population across the board, you don't really see marked differences between vegans and, like, pescatarians. For example, the pescatarians are having some dairy, they're having some fish, which are particularly low-fat dairy being among some of the healthiest animal products. Mm-hmm. Obviously, not having red meat, I can't recall if they were having much in the way of, like, high fat, you know, like creams and butters and things. I would assume probably not given the population, but I'd have to double check that. Mm-hmm. But when we look at that data, the results are roughly comparable. There might be a slight advantage one way for one of the dietary patterns, a slight advantage the other way for, you know, the other one, but it's a wash at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And when we look at research on, Mediterranean diets, we have the probably strongest data for just based on the volume of it. We see that, you know, the results we see there are comparable to the results that we see in some of the studies on vegan diets and things like ischemic heart disease. So that is why I say that. And I know that there will be vegans perhaps listening who want me to say that the vegan diet is better, but I think that actually hurts the movement. I think it hurts the movement to make false claims because guess what? It gives fodder to people to say that we're making stuff up. Whereas I'd rather be objective. Look at the data as it is. And I think the ethical argument is so strong that we don't need to make stuff up. You know, we can talk about the ethical considerations. We can talk about the environmental considerations, like I said, to at least very close, if not exclusively plant-based. And then the fact that it's a healthy dietary pattern and compatible with these other healthy dietary patterns is fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Great points. And so when it comes to, you know, fully going 100% vegan or plant-based versus, you know, the 80-90%, what are some potential disadvantages from a nutritional standpoint, and how would someone who made that decision from an ethical point of view, how would they, you know, kind of plug those gaps that maybe you know, occurring as a result mm-hmm. of giving up these animal foods?
Well, the obvious one is B12. Making sure that, yes, you can rely on fortified foods. I suggest just supplementing because it is so easy, so cheap. And there's no guesswork done. You don't have to worry about, am I having a certain number of servings a day of these fortified, whatever they are. So B12 supplementation, I think, is an important one. Depending on where you live, vitamin D supplementation can be important as well. Like, I live up here in Vancouver. It's like almost summer now. It's kind of overcast outside. Probably not getting much vitamin D if I go out there, especially with the skin tone. So vitamin D is potentially an important one. And obviously you can test if there's any guesswork being done or you aren't sure. And then in that same theme is sort of the vitamin D, because that is important for bone health. I think calcium can be a concern. And where it can be a concern is in people who are removing dairy, but not filling it with other calcium fortified foods. But that goes beyond just vegans. If you look at any kind of coffee shop nowadays, you'll see a lot of people ordering oat lattes, soy lattes, whatever. Who are perhaps reducing their dairy intake, whether they're omnivorous or not. But fortunately, those milks that they're using there are fortified. Mm-hmm. And so I do recommend that people consume a couple cups of calcium fortified plant-based milk a day if they were to go that route, or supplement. So those are the two options. Now, on that note, there was a study done. This was an Adventist Health Study 2 as well, done. I think it was published 3 years ago or so, maybe 4 years ago, looking at bone health, hip fracture risk. And they found that vegan women did have a higher risk of hip fracture. There wasn't a significant risk amongst men. But the vegan women had a higher risk of hip fracture. But when you accounted for just those who were supplementing both vitamin D and calcium, there was no significant increase in risk. If anything, the data even might have pointed towards a slight benefit compared to the omnivores. So it just shows that it is important to make sure you have those nutrients in check. And of course, if you do, then you can maintain good bone health. A fourth new. Sorry, you slow me down and ask questions if there's anything on it, because I'm like running through.
Yeah, you're covering it. We're good. Okay. I like to get through the content, and honestly, everything's very clear. You know, in terms of calcium, like you mentioned. The other thing. So what you were just saying with that, like I had that exact conversation with a client who is plant based. Just like last week of like, okay, you're going to need to consume something that's calcium fortified on a regular basis, whether, no matter what, you know, what that is, whatever you choose, you know, plant-based milk is the easiest thing.
Yeah.
But we need to get that into your diet on a regular basis because you were consistently low in calcium and it's probably been the case for years. And that's when it really can become problematic, is if it's been the case for years. And, you know, besides bone health, there could be other, you know, potential complications with low calcium intake that, you know, we tend to overlook. And this is why I tend to emphasize overall in my messaging, you know, we need to pay attention to energy intake and then micronutrient intake and individual micronutrients. And, you know, sometimes it's helpful to track your intake for a period of time just to see where you're at in terms of like calcium, zinc, and other nutrients, especially if you're making a dietary change that, you know, you may not really know if you're getting adequate levels of certain things. So, yeah, great points. And I know people are going to be thinking, is there ways to test for these? So let's continue on with the other nutrients, and then we'll summarize, and then we'll talk about whether, you know, kind of the best ways to pay attention to these things. But what are the other things besides, you know, calcium and that we need to be paying attention to?
You did mention macronutrients there. I think the one that we could talk about quickly is protein as well. So when equated, when you're having the same amount of animal protein to plant protein or vice versa, The results are roughly the same based on the trials we have, at least with strength training. However, when you consider most animal foods and most plant foods, animal foods just provide more protein, right? On average. Mm-hmm. So what I do emphasize as well is to center your meals around a high protein food, and to choose those high protein foods that are comparable to animal products. So like per calorie, let's say an 80% lean beef, provides roughly the same amount of protein as tofu does. If you take an extra lean beef, it's more comparable to something like seitan or textured vegetable protein, which is like soy protein with the fat removed and has sort of a meaty texture. I think lentil or chickpea pastas are fantastic ways to get like sneaky protein in there, because normally pasta would be very low. Mm-hmm. And then using some like plant-based meat alternatives as well, ideally those that are lower in saturated fat and lower in sodium. If I was to throw a couple out there, say the Eve's veggie ground or the Gardein veggie grounds, or the newest iteration of the Beyond Burger, which unfortunately isn't in Canada yet. It is, in the US, the avocado oil one. It's very low in saturated fat and about 300 milligrams of sodium. We're actually seeing some options that sort of fit that bill. And I actually have a paper, it's my first lead author credit, will be in the Canadian Journal of Cardiology in June, looking at plant-based meats and cardiovascular risk. So, we kind of review all the data there. But I would say that emphasizing protein-rich foods as a centerpiece to at least two out of, say, three meals a day, or what I do to get extra protein is I'll toss them in my oatmeal as well, just a protein powder in there to bump up the protein content. So I'm actually getting three like solid doses of protein throughout the day.
Yeah, good point. And is Morningstar Farms available in Canada?
Mm-hmm, I haven't seen it. Okay, I've heard the name. I haven't seen it.
And so my son is a vegetarian. He has been since he was like 6 years now. He's been since he was four. Like, it was like right after Thanksgiving. I think he saw the turkey and was like, okay, now this really makes sense to me. Because I had this conversation with him. Like, we're eating an actual chicken. And I think he saw the whole turkey and was like, put the two together, because he's just an animal lover. And I kind of expected him to be vegetarian at some point, just the way that he is. I've tried everything. Morningstar Farms has some really good options. Like, they have a chicken that's textured vegetable protein with a little bit of oil and some additives to it, but it's, I think it's 23 grams of protein per like 130 calories.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's like super high.
They have a beef crumble that's similar. I think it's like 17 per 110 or something like that. Like, they have really upped their products on the plant-based. So I've been trying these products. My son does not like
plant-based meat alternatives. Like he is not a fan, and now he's
there's no meat.
Finally taking on these Morningstar Farm. Like he's these are the ones that he likes, and I'm like, yes, this makes me getting his protein need like meeting his protein needs a lot easier. Because before it was just he's a vegetarian, not a vegan, so I would just do cheese in pretty much every meal to try to get that extra protein and the beans, the plant-based pastas, the lentils, like basically in every single meal. We have, you know, some type of tofu, beans, lentils, or plant-based pasta, so that he's getting that protein. So that's definitely an important one in terms of macronutrients. And as you mentioned, in terms of when it comes to protein, I talk about all this in the protein episode. So I have a protein episode that I'll link in the show notes. So anyone listening who wants to hear more about that, I talk about the difference between plant and animal protein. The data on, you know, muscle gain and then also health, and why, you know, there's a good reason to include plenty of plant-based protein, even if you're not going to go vegan, still including these, you know, beans and lentils and other plant-based foods, soy, edamame. One of the things that I know some people are going to think is, you know, these plant-based, you know, meat alternatives, they're processed.
Yeah.
So, Are they healthy because they're processed is the question.
Yeah. So when we look at research on ultra processed foods, I think actually before even going to that, we should talk about what an ultra processed food is. Mm-hmm. So something is classified as ultra processed if it's made primarily of industrial ingredients. That if I was to boil down the NOVA classification to like its simplest term, that's how it would come out. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at like a package, let's consider a whole wheat bread that's packaged and bought from the store. That's considered an ultra-processed food. Yep. Let's take a whole grain breakfast cereal like Cheerios. That's considered an ultra-processed food, even though both of those are consistently associated with good long-term health outcomes. At the same time, sugar-sweetened beverages like your Coca-Colas, Pepsis, they're considered ultra-processed foods and consistently associated with poor outcomes. And then some like processed meat, sausages, things like that, ultra-processed foods, poor outcomes. When we look at the data that actually separates out different kinds of ultra-processed foods, looking at outcomes related to like diabetes, liver health, we have one kind of looking at cardiovascular disease, but it combines it with some other outcomes. We see that it's primarily driven by those like ultra-processed meat products and the sugar-sweetened beverages. And then some products like the whole wheat breads and whole grain cereals are actually beneficial. So just because something's considered ultra-processed, we can't necessarily consider it bad. Like even a lot of plant-based milks are considered ultra processed just by virtue of how they're produced, which is crazy, right?
Yeah. I mean, protein powders, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So many different things that are quote unquote considered ultra processed. So
yeah, exactly.
I think the point there is, you know, when it comes to nutrition, there's certain things that we know to be harm. And with respect to ultra processed foods, there's certain things that we need to be concerned with, excess sodium, excess sugar, excess saturated fat that's added into any of these foods or as a part of it as in processed meats. And then certain additives that like the nitrates in the processed meats can potentially be a problem. And then we really just don't know the cumulative effect of consuming the different preservatives and additives and coloring agents if it makes up a large percentage of your diet. So that's where, you know, if you're allowing these foods to make up a large percentage of your diet and you're not consuming a diet that's primarily made of unprocessed and minimally processed foods, that's when it can really become a problem. But if you're including these foods and they're not causing you to consume too much sodium or sugar or saturated fats, and, you know, they're providing you with protein or fiber, in many cases, you know, some of these things have fiber added to them and other nutrients as well, you know, it's not that big of a deal. So definitely don't want to, because I this is a big one that I know people struggle with, is they're trying to meet their protein needs, but they don't want to include processed foods into their normal meals. And you know, I really, if it's helping you meet your protein needs, it's helping you meet your nutritional needs, and it's doing you more good than harm by including it into your diet.
Yeah, and actually there are a number of randomized controlled trials. I was actually surprised when I was going over the data for my review, the one that I mentioned, there were like nine, because there were a couple that came out after I wrote the review, randomized controlled trials actually looking or utilizing plant-based meats and comparing them to meat products, and consistently neutral to positive, depending on the marker, like beneficial for cholesterol levels, ApoB levels, Pretty neutral for blood pressure despite having a lot of sodium a lot of the time, which is sort of surprising, maybe offset by some of the fiber or seasonings that are used on meats, who knows. But when you're using it as a replacement for meat, especially if you're using it as a sort of a transitionary food, if anything, the data does point towards it being positive.
Yeah, I agree with that too. A lot of people won't just because of the processing piece of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're going to make both the some of the plant-based people mad and then some of the other people on the other side of it who are like promoting omnivorous diets. Because I see a lot of people saying, just criticizing plant-based meats by calling them processed. And even people who otherwise like have good nutritional advice still kind of leaning in that direction. And I think it's just some people just have, I feel like an emotional response towards like vegetarian, vegan, plant-based diets. It's like, no, we don't. For some reason, there's like a, some people get a certain way about it. And I've gone that way and eaten that way. And most of my health markers improve when I'm on a more plant-based diet. And, you know, I feel better when I include a little bit of animal foods because it helps me to meet my protein needs more easily and omega-3 fatty acids and all of that. But, you know, yeah, that I think, you know, more people, in my opinion, would benefit by just allowing their dietary pattern to move in this direction, sometimes having some meals without and just exploring that a little bit more because, you know, doing that myself forced me to eat more plants. And then I realized that that was like what I really needed from a health perspective was mainly just eating more plants. But I had to like stop centering my meals around animal products in order to, you know, feel that benefit and really kind of go in that direction. So some other nutrients, you mentioned protein now, you mentioned calcium. What are some other things that we really need to be considering if someone's going to be eating a more plant-based diet?
Yeah, I think now we get into sort of the realm of possibly a concern, but I wouldn't say the data is clear enough. So one of them would be iodine. Iodine, I mean, we know we need iodine. It's in iodized salt, but a lot of people are choosing things like pink Himalayan salt, which, by the way, is like a marketing scam. I would not recommend that. I would say do iodized regular iodized salt. For the iodine, and then you don't have to worry about it.
The last episode.
Yeah, so there that you'll get, hopefully they get the double whammy of that message. But I think just stick with an iodized salt and you're probably in the clear. It really doesn't take, like half a teaspoon in a day basically gets your iodine needs, depending on the salt. I think there might be variability in the amount, but it's 150 micrograms a day. And actually, we see that regardless of dietary pattern, when urine iodine levels are measured, they're low, but they just tend to be even lower in vegans because they aren't consuming dairy, which has added iodine. They aren't consuming fish, which can be a source. And then, of course, if they are swapping away from iodized salt, then they aren't having that either. But when we look at research on like hypothyroidism and plant-based diets, vegan or vegetarian diets, we actually don't see a significant increase in risk based on the limited data, but we don't have a ton. So I'd say err on the side of caution, use some iodized salt. Mm-hmm. The next one would be zinc. This is sort of a similar idea in that we don't have good data suggesting that vegans actually have like overt zinc deficiency at a higher rate. In fact, as far as I'm aware, it's not even that common in the general population. But because zinc from plant sources may be somewhat less bioavailable, and because plant foods just tend to consume less, at least than certain animal products, it is good to focus on zinc-rich foods like hemp seeds, pumpkin seeds, potentially considering a supplement. But again, it's just we don't have good data that it is a concern. It's just more of a precautionary measure to make sure that you're getting that. And then the last one I would really hone in on is probably the long-chain omega-3 fats. So we consume alpha-linolenic acid from like flax seeds, walnuts, chia seeds, canola oil, seed oil, and like soy actually contains a fair bit too. And so we're getting these short-chain omega-3s that in our body will then be converted to EPA and DHA, the long-chain omega-3s that many people get from things like fish. Now, fortunately, we have vegan alternatives to that. We have algae-based supplements, which are identical to the fish-based ones. So we can supplement it from that source. But I would really like to see research on vegans who supplement versus those who don't, looking at long-term outcomes. Because as we noted earlier, vegans do tend to have a lower risk of cardiovascular outcomes already. So the question is there further benefit? Because that is one of the proposed benefits. It's not that vegans are suffering without supplementing, it's that there's potential for an added benefit. And we can also consider that there's potential for some cognitive benefits too, but the data, especially in young, healthy people, isn't very impressive there. So I would say it's a precautionary measure, something that people could consider. It is certainly a more pricey option. But I would stop short of saying it's absolutely necessary based on the current balance of evidence. Other than like in pregnancy, it's definitely indicated, breastfeeding, there's better data there.
Yeah, definitely. I have an episode on that too. And you summarized it right now about what I recommend around
awesome.
Vegan diet. So it definitely, you can tell we both read the same literature in terms of the research, because you covered all the same things that I was, talked about in that episode in terms of like pregnancy and vegetarian and vegan diet. So I'll link that in the show notes as well. And then also in terms of like supplementation, like we don't really know. And it's probably genetic factors that play a role in the conversion. And I talk about that in the episode. It can get kind of complicated, like in terms of converting the alpha-linolenic acid to the long-chain omega-3 fatty acids. And I think that there's probably some value in these cases in getting a blood test and getting like an omega-3 test. Are you familiar with that?
The omega-3 index. Yeah. Yeah. We can run that here.
So, I mean, in some cases, I feel like if someone's really concerned about it, just run the omega-3 index and see where your EPA and DHA levels are. And if you're like low on that end, then it may be more, beneficial to supplement. But even then, I'm not sure the data is really that strong there.
Yeah, I would think
better, it's better than guessing, but
Here's my problem. I'll just quickly tell you now I think it's fine to obviously test and kind of see where you're at and make a decision. My problem is I've only seen one study looking at omega-3 index that has actually adjusted for diet. So it's very likely that higher omega-3 index just means you're eating more fish and therefore less of other stuff. And therefore you have a better diet quality. Like it's actually interestingly an area where the research is not very good.
I didn't think about that. I don't know. I don't think I've ever paid attention to whether or not you're adjusting for fish intake. That would make complete sense. I do know that part of that is also, there is some genetic component to that conversion, to where some people 100%. Are going to be perfectly fine with, consuming ALA, and others just not going to be able to meet their needs, even if they're, consuming plenty of flaxseed, or not meet their needs, but get in the baseline levels of DHA that are generally recommended, because that would require pretty high levels of conversion versus what we've normally seen. Yeah. In terms of, so you mentioned B12, vitamin D, zinc, calcium. So is there a way, because would someone supplement with these individually, or would you recommend just take a multivitamin and don't worry about it, or how would you go about that?
Yeah, I honestly, so if we were to go bare bones, the things that are, in my view, I wouldn't absolutely say necessary, because there are some factors, but close to necessary, you can just do a B12, you can do a vitamin D, you can focus on nutrition for pretty much everything else there, right? Fortified foods with calcium and things like that. So you could probably get away with that. However, what I recommend to a lot of my patients is just a simple multivitamin that covers those bases. There are some out there. There are some that are pretty, cost effective. There's the one by Diva. So like Diva Vegan Multi. I'm not sponsored by them or anything. It's just, I think they're very cheap, well formulated. The vitamin D is maybe a little bit on the low end for some people, but you can always supplement an additional vitamin D. And then you just have one pill that covers you pretty well. Other than I think actually the calcium is a little low too, but it covers the zinc, it covers the iodine, it covers the B12, it covers a lot of the other micro zinc. There's also Complement. They have some that actually, they include, I believe, DHA in that as well. So that's an option, but full disclosure, that is one that I'm affiliated with. So I want to put that out there.
Okay.
And then there's a new one that I've seen around shops here in Vancouver And I'm not sure if it's available in the States, but from Prairie Naturals, it's pretty well formulated as well, just based on what I've seen. But it might be Platinum Naturals. It's one something natural that starts with a P. But anyways, that is one that I've looked at and looks like it's pretty well formulated as well. No matter what, you're probably going to find that there's one nutrient that's like a bit off in the multi, maybe a little low or something, and you can just supplement that. But two pills is better than like five or six. I certainly like the use of multis to make things easy. But some people are like, I've had patients where I'm like, we can do this one multi or we can do these, you know, five individually. But like, I want the individual one. Okay, yeah. That's your call, right? Go for it. And so we'll do it that way.
Yeah, I'm also a fan of the multivitamin, and I've worked with people in that same way. But, you know, it's just simple to take, you know, a multivitamin that's just covering your bases. Focus on nutrition, but if you can just, you know, like you said, the B12, the zinc, you know those bases are covered. Like, I give my son a multivitamin every other day. Like, I don't even give it to him every day because I know he doesn't necessarily need it every day, because it's a, you know, full, you know, multivitamin. And so that is in terms of multivitamins, would you like, I'm gonna have to get like your links for that or information about that, because I tried to write it down, but I'm probably writing them wrong in terms of the actual brands. But yeah, protein, and then we talked about the other nutrients. You can cover that with a multivitamin, or you can go individually. Protein, you can really, you know, adjust your diet, include a lot of plant-based meat alternatives. You can include protein powder. You can include lots of different protein-rich foods and try to combine those in various meals. Is there anything else in terms of like adopting a you know, more plant-based diet that would be a consideration?
There's one other nutrient I just thought of. I can't believe we skipped it, or I skipped it. Was iron, actually. So that's one that gets brought up a lot. So what's really interesting about this is when you look at like any study done on Western population, you don't actually see significant differences in iron deficiency rates between the vegans and meat eaters on average. There's a few possible explanations for this. For one, vegans tend to consume a lot more iron. In some populations, it's like double the total amount of iron, because plant foods generally contain more iron than animal foods. But certain animal foods have more bioavailable iron. Mm-hmm. So although you're consuming twice as much, you end up getting about the same amount, if mm-hmm. that makes sense, because you're absorbing less. Now, there are also certain things that you can do to up absorption. So consuming it with vitamin C, for example, increases absorption. Onion and garlic may increase absorption to a degree, but then other things like coffee and tea might impair absorption. Mm-hmm. So you want to maximize those absorption boosters and minimize those absorption inhibitors. That being said, if you're regularly consuming these iron-rich foods with those other things, the effect tends to diminish, at least for some of them, like some of the inhibitors. Things like phytates, I know that gets spewed by the like carnivore crowd.
Talked about that two episodes ago.
Yeah, but
when you look on iron inhibitors as well.
Good. So you've already got that. But yeah, when you're actually habitually consuming them regularly, that inhibitory effect seems to diminish or go away. And so we actually regulate absorption of non-heme iron, that iron that we get from plant sources. And it's actually found in animal sources to a smaller degree. But when we consume that iron, we regulate absorption. So if we need more, our body upregulates absorption to a degree. If we don't need more, we decrease absorption. Whereas with heme iron from things like red meat, it's pretty consistent. It's within a relatively small range. So it's, again, not super clear that it's a huge concern for vegans, but it's just a huge concern in general, particularly for women. That's the thing. So I don't want to wave it away as like, oh, vegans don't need to worry. No, a lot of people need to worry, whether vegan or not, especially if you're menstruating. And in those cases where there is deficiency, I go straight to a supplement. I don't even bother trying to deal with that through food. Yes, you might be able to manage it with food depending on how low it is. But for the majority of people, the supplement's just going to be way better. It's going to boost your levels much higher. And then some people will still not respond to supplements, in which case things like infusions are possibly indicated.
Yeah. And like you mentioned, iron, glad you brought it up because it's really important. And I agree. I don't see major differences. Typically, I've seen
you know, omnivores be just mm-hmm. as iron deficient as people on more plant-based diets. And I think that's because, like you mentioned, the higher intake, but low iron levels will lead to low energy levels, can lead to low,
yep.
Low mood, can really affect your entire being in a variety of different ways that, when you supplement and get back up, like this is one of those supplements yeah. that can be like a magic supplement if you get back up to.
I'll tell you a story actually about a patient really quick. So I had a patient who, she was struggling with some gastrointestinal symptoms for a while, and she was, you know, low energy, not crazy low energy though, surprisingly. Like she was doing pretty well. We tested her a few things. We tested for like celiac disease and whatnot, and we tested her iron levels, and it just read less than one. So like it wasn't even, it was the first time I'd ever seen that in practice. And after further investigation, and she went to a gastroenterologist, we found that she had an autoimmune gastritis. And so she just was not absorbing at all. And so she actually has to do recurrent infusions. So we do infusions regularly to keep her levels up. But it's like once she has that, she realizes how bad she felt, because she actually was so used to it that she didn't feel that bad. And then, you know, when she got those levels up, it was like a world of difference.
Yeah, this is one of those things that, I mean, with a lot of, when you do the right things, it can feel like a miracle. It can really yeah. feel like you completely changed your life. And I want to kind of go off of that point. You mentioned she got used to it and didn't feel that bad. I feel like that's, I feel like a lot of people just walk around like that. Like, I feel like so many people are walking around just feeling so much less healthy, energetic, clear-minded than they should, simply due to poor lifestyle choices. And it's not even, you know, it's not you're doing all the things wrong. It's just really just not being consistent in planning ahead and making this a priority in terms of like, you know, your sleep and your nutrition and some of these other things that we just let other things in life, you know, become more important. And I think for a lot of people, because this happened to me and you experienced it too, is we just got convinced that this was going to make a big difference. And then I made drastic changes quickly, and then I felt how much better I was supposed to feel quickly. And then it's like, oh, I don't want to go back to how I felt before. So once mm-hmm. once you make like, and sometimes I feel like there's some value to making some drastic changes. Like I'm a big fan of consistent habit change over time, because you're going to feel better over time. And it's, you know, it's more sustainable oftentimes in that way. But sometimes, you know, really being a little bit more drastic with your changes in a shorter period of time can allow you to see the difference of how you can feel quickly. And it's motivating and kind of prevents you from going back. Because that's one of the things about your story that I thought was interesting, is you kind of backslid, but then you were, yeah. I know how I'm supposed to feel and I want to get back there. And it's like, there's no point in my life where I'm not going to prioritize these things, because just a week or two and I can feel the, you know, a week or two of travel and just inconsistent schedule, the difference that I can feel in terms of energy levels, in terms of mood, joint pain, all of that is huge. So, you know, anyone who's listening to this is kind of like teetering on the fence and, you know, you're you know, not really fully invested or haven't really fully, you know, taken that step. I would encourage you to really give yourself, you know, maybe, you know, when life is, you know, you're not traveling, you have a little bit lower stress, just say, you know what, for this 30 days, I'm going to really prioritize my health. And I'm going to put all, you know, I'm going to make that the most important thing for myself for the next couple of months. And if you do that for a lot of people, you're going to feel so much better after those couple of months that you'll never go back. And sometimes you'll benefit from hiring someone when you go through that process. Actually, most of the time you'll benefit from hiring someone if you can, if you have the means. If not, just kind of doing it on your own is also a really good, you know, just kind of giving you a runway to focus on that and build those habits and feel the difference, I think is really, really helpful.
Yeah. And I'd also say there's, you know, a lot of like online support groups, like Facebook groups and things that are obviously free. If anyone wants just like that little bit of maybe a push or accountability or have others that are going through it too. Like that's another way to go. Again, if you can't afford to work with a professional or something, at least there's something there that you can have sort of a community.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I appreciate you coming on. I feel like we covered quite a bit of great information in terms of like getting started, what are the important nutrients to pay attention to. And really, in my opinion, the nutrients are really where we just, if you know the nutrients and you understand, okay, let me just make sure I'm getting enough calcium, make sure I'm getting enough protein, omega-3, just make sure I'm getting some ALA if I want to supplement, you know, kind of look into that more. If you have that in place, you know, there's no disadvantage to going onto a more plant-based diet. A lot of people wonder about, you know, muscle mass. Like, I eat mostly plant-based foods and I'm 205 pounds. Like, it's total calories and protein. Like, that's what matters. It's not whether or not, like, most of my protein is plant-based protein. I buy like 1 to 2 pounds of like animal protein a week probably. And everything else is coming from plant-based sources for the most part. And a lot of people are surprised when I say that because, you know, I'm a larger person that maintains a higher amount of muscle mass. And it's like, as long as you're eating the right amount of calories and you're eating the right amount of protein and you're meeting those nutritional needs, you know, there's not really many disadvantages to going this route. Now, there is one from a digestive standpoint. If you start to eat a lot more plant-based foods, just you might want to go into it slowly because you probably are going to feel, you know, bloated. You're probably going to have more gas as your microbiome is adjusting to that higher fiber intake, because, you know, I have a whole episode on fiber. I've talked about this already, but you know, we don't digest fiber, and it can be a little bit difficult on your GI tract if you're taking in a lot and your digestive system hasn't adjusted to that properly. So if you are going to kind of move in this direction, I would say probably take it a stepwise approach in terms of increasing your fiber intake and understand that there's going to be an adjustment period. It's not that these foods are harming your gut, because a lot of times people think, oh, I'm, you know, it doesn't feel good. So this is you know, this is not the right dietary change. And it's really your GI tract needs to get adjusted to those foods, and your microbiome will shift in a positive direction to be able to help you digest those fiber-rich foods as you continue to eat them regularly.
Yeah, and like, you know, something I do with a lot of my patients when, you know, I'll get people who are maybe interested in making that sort of a transition, I'll just kind of review their diet, and I'll look at what's just an easy swap you can make. Like, let's say they typically have pasta with beef-based sauce or something. Okay, just swap that out for like ground tofu, or again, one of those even plant-based meat alternatives. As a really small shift, you're upping the fiber a little bit, but you're not, you know, making this huge drastic different change to your diet. And then, you know, do that for a week or two. The next week, maybe tweak something else. And you can do it slowly like that. And even those modest shifts might, you know, lead to some improvements, at least for biomarkers like cardiometabolic risk factors, versus going all in overnight and upping your fiber by 50 grams and wreaking havoc. Because there are studies looking at like really increasing bean consumption and those gut symptoms, and they do seem to go away at about 3 months for most people. So a lot of people within a month, but for the rest, or the majority of the rest, by 3 months. But rather than going through that for a few months, if you just take it slow, you can, you know, avoid it altogether.
Yeah, that's a great tip, and I would recommend anyone who kind of listened to this and, you know, is thinking about exploring consuming more plant-based foods, just start there. Just like Matt said, just kind of, you know, if you have a pasta with ground beef, switch it for a ground beef alternative, or lentils, or some other, you know, tofu, some other plant-based protein source. And that's a really good place to start. And your gut will adjust. Like I tracked my intake recently, and I hadn't in a while, and I was surprised. I'm like, I eat like 70 grams of fiber a day. And like, you know, a lot of people wouldn't be able to handle that, but I've just eaten lots of plant-based foods for a long period of time, and my digestive system handles it just fine. And I'm someone, haven't talked about this much on the podcast, but I dealt with like lots of GI issues when I was younger, like all the time, and had pretty significant GI issues in my early 20s. That's one of the reasons that I started like into nutrition, is because it helped me improve my GI issues going on a more plant-based diet, like really significantly improve things. So let's tell the listeners where they can find you, where they can learn more, because I know you are
an absolute wealth of information. So like, truly, if you enjoy this podcast, you're going to enjoy like following Matt on social media, because the way that he breaks down the research is just, I really appreciate it. Like when I see you break down a study, I'm like, I know that I'm probably going to read it and just come to the same conclusions. And I really appreciate that about it. I'm like, oh, Matt broke it down. I don't know if I really need to get into it too much. I'll go read it and be like, oh yeah, that's exactly how he described it as well. So I really appreciate that about you. And I know listeners are going to really appreciate that as well. So where can they follow you?
Well, yeah, thanks. And obviously I follow you as well, and always keeping up with the like debunks and things that you're putting out there, which I'm trying to get into a little more, but you know, the comments are too much to deal with sometimes. Yeah, I know, man. But anyways, people can follow me on basically any social media. I'm definitely most active on Instagram, but I also post the same clips to YouTube, to TikTok, just kind of everywhere. Get it out there. And I also have an email newsletter that I'll kind of throw highlights each month, just a once a month newsletter, which you can join at the link in my Instagram bio or through my website, drmatthewnagra.com. And of course, if you're in BC and want to connect or even work with me, then you can reach out and we can sort that out too.
Cool. So quickly, what's your Instagram handle?
Oh yeah. At DR. So Dr. DR dot Matthew Nagra. Two T's. Okay.
M-A-T-T-H-E-W dot N-A-G-R-A.
No. DR dot M-A-T-T-H-E-W-N-A-G-R-A.
Okay.
So there's no dot in between. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. Cause most people don't click on links. I'm going to put the link in the show notes, but I know it's better to say it because a lot of times people aren't going to go to the show notes. So thank you for repeating that. And thank you for coming on the show. I know this is going to be a great episode and people got a lot of value from it. So I really appreciate it.
Awesome. And hopefully we do it again.
Yeah, definitely.